Well, as we're about to point out, there's a problem, which is people who are depending on the audio have a problem this week because somebody at Red Hat did an update to Fedora that's breaking the encoders, and so I'm having real trouble getting the audio online at the moment. So, surprise. And I also think that and there's a second problem with not showing up, right, which is you don't get to ask questions, but also other people don't get to hear your questions, and that's part of the question interaction, so what can you do? All right. This log structured file system idea is kind of a peculiar idea. And it's both appealing and frustrating at the same time. It's appealing in the sense that you've got a file system that's much more likely to survive mishap because it's got this logging and transactional thing going on. It's frustrating in the sense that the transaction is happening at, in some sense, at the wrong level of abstraction. Right? So what I'd really like, assuming now that I'm going to stay within the Unix world, what I would really like is a scheme where an application can turn to the file subsystem and say, I'm about to do a bunch of changes to a bunch of files, and either they all need to happen or none of them need to happen. I mean, once you're going to put the transaction mechanism in, why hide it? And the answer is, well, because the POSIX API doesn't give you a way to expose it. You'd have to, those applications would now have to appeal to a specialized API. They would become non-portable. And this, you know, there's always this sort of catch-22 with such non-portable interfaces. But for example, the password program, which has to update both the etc password and etc shadow files, would really benefit from that. So, and I've mentioned this issue before, right, that the unit of consistency really is the file, and if you get stuck in an update, A, you could lose the file, and B, if you've updated multiple files, you could lose one but not both of them, which could be bad, depending on what it was you were doing. So, what I want to tell you about today is a completely different style of doing persistence. It's got nothing to do with files. And it's not something that I think would be feasible to implement in a Unix-style system. Certainly, it would be extremely complex. But it has been implemented, and in practice works quite well. So here's the idea. Suppose we said, that we sort of want to turn the tables on the way we normally think about the kernel. We think about the kernel as something that has data structures that it's willing to reveal to us. Is there something so fascinating on the laptop that it's helping you? Then why are you wasting time on it? And more importantly, why are you wasting my time on it? This is not the right place to do that. Either take it out or close it. We think of the kernel as something that has data structures that it's provisionally willing to reveal to us. But we have a system call interface between us and the kernel that kind of stands in the way of getting access to the data. And suppose we took that view and turned it upside down. And we said, actually what's going to happen is the kernel is going to act entirely as a cache. So when we talk about a process structure in the kernel, it's going to act like a process in all the ways that we've talked about, but the state of that process is going to be obtained from someplace else. And the way we're going to think about it is when the kernel wants to run a process, the first step is say, oh, if I don't have this process in my cache, I need to load it, and I need to turn to somebody else to get the state. And if I run out of space in my cache, I need to unload it, and I need to push it out to somebody else. And there are two families of kernels, maybe three, depending on how you look at it, that have been designed in this way.
When you say unload, do you mean actually changing the process state or leaving whatever state it was and just put it somewhere else?
I mean actually taking the process state and shipping it off to somebody else to save it.
Okay, but the
removing it from memory.
But the process doesn't have to do any unloading or
No, no, it's being done by the kernel. It is completely invisible to the process. Okay. So there are two families of kernels that have done this. One is the cache kernel, the Stanford cache kernel, which was Chariton et al. And the other is the Kikos, Eros, Kiotis lines of kernel. And Eros and Kiotis are projects that are being done here. Eros was, Kiotis is. So here's the notion. The notion is now that we're going to build an object system. And objects, in this sense, are objects in the operating system sense in terms. The kinds of objects we're talking about are pages, mapping structures, processes, things like that. Not objects in the sense of job. Okay. And the kernel is now going to manage this object system, and every object is going to have a unique ID. So instead of having a process ID in the Unix sense, right, we're going to replace that notion with a process object ID. And you'll find that object ID quickly gets abbreviated OID every place where it gets used. So when you say, I want to send a message to the process whose OID is 5,000,002, the kernel says, well, I don't know anything about 5,000,002, so step one is I'm going to go to some object server and I'm going to ask it to hand me the bits associated with the process state for 5,000,002. The object server here is trusted. It's part of it's inside the security memory. It's part of the implementation of the security memory. And it is the only thing in this design that is entitled to look at state that we would normally think of as kernel internal. Maybe before starting with processing, we should talk about this for pages. Right? So in a monolithic kernel, we would say, hey, I've got a page, I'm out of room in memory, the page has been modified, I've got to put it down somewhere, let me write it to the swap array. The same sort of thing can happen in this kind of design, and it's very frequently done in microkernels, that when the kernel runs out of storage, it says, oh, I have a page, it's dirty, I'm out of space in memory, I gotta get rid of it. Let me ask some server to take it out of memory for me. And then that server, which is application code, but it's special application code because it has access to kernel bits through some interface, turns around and actually implements writing the page to disk. In fact, in microkernel systems, device drivers aren't in the kernel either. The kernel literally can't write the page to disk. It has to ask some piece of application code to do this. Now, this gets a little tricky because you have to understand now that the fact that something is an application does not mean that it is non-privileged. Drivers obviously have very intimate access to the hardware. They can do just about anything. They are just as trusted as the kernel, and they have to be. But just like the kernel could page pages in and out from the swap area in the file system, you can imagine that there might be a third choice that it could page a page in from some kind of a server that it would talk to via some kind of communication mechanism. And in fact, once you had that, the kernel doesn't really need a file server anymore. It can always just go to the object server. The Unix kernel does something very much like this when it obtains file data from NFS. Right? The traditional implementation of NFS is not in the kernel. And the way it works is that there's some kind of a communication endpoint that the kernel does implement. Okay? And the protocol that's implemented here is essentially, it's the file system protocol, but by the file system protocol, I do not mean the open, close, read, write one that you see at the application layer. What I actually mean here is something very much closer to the file system interface layer inside the kernel. So if this file system were implemented in the kernel, right, we'd have a big piece of source code to compile. This source code, in the end, right, only its interface, but you would publish a data structure. That data structure would have a bunch of procedure pointers. Right? And those procedure, the fields would mean something like VFS open. Right? As you trace through the kernel, you probably went into some of this code, because there's a point as you're going through the open logic, right? Step one is figure out which file system I got to talk to. Step two is ask that file system to do the rest of the work. So what happens at this communication endpoint is there is a VFS structure in the kernel, but what that VFS structure does is it takes the kernel's request, serializes it into a message string, and hands that message string up to the NFS server. The NFS server deserializes it, interprets it, as far as the kernel is concerned, does whatever is required by magic, because the kernel doesn't know how that's accomplished. That's the business of the NFS server. Turns back to the kernel and says, okay, here's the answer. Serializes that answer into a message, drops the message back to the kernel. This proxy VFS layer in the kernel deserializes it back into a kernel data structure and hands that back, and at this point the kernel has no more knowledge that the file system was not in fact a kernel internal file system. Now that's not quite true, because there are some reductio issues. One of the things that you would not want to do here is load the NFS server from the file system served by the NFS server. We could imagine some contortions that might actually let you load that server by magic, right? And then it would be loaded and then it could talk to NFS for you. But you better keep it in memory, because if it gets paged out, what's going to happen? You're going to say, oh, I paged this out, I need to run this code again, let me go ask for the code again from the file system. And now you're going to call the NFS layer, because this thing is in the NFS layer. You say, good, I need some piece of a file. And the NFS layer is going to say, good, I'll get you that piece of a file, chunk, 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 and it hits the code you haven't hit yet, and takes the page fault that's exactly the page fault you're trying to resolve. So somewhere this has to ground out at the bottom. And usually the way you ground it out is you have some kind of a RAM disk that you're loading the system from the beginning of the world, or you load these drivers by magic, or a couple of these servers by magic, and you just ping them in memory so that they can't go out. But once you get past this sort of, I have to think my way through the bootstrap process pretty carefully, this idea that I could take this procedure call at the file system layer, right, serialize it and turn it into a remote message, is actually not such a hairy idea. Now, in this case, with the NFS server, the way it was actually designed is there's actually an NFS client, right? This thing is presenting the local illusion of the file system. And it turns out there's a whole other layer of serialization, because this thing goes out over a wire and it talks to an NFS server that's running someplace else entirely. And again, all it's doing is taking that procedure call, packaging up the arguments in a string and shipping them around. If you've done RMI stuff in Java, it's the same idea. Now, it's not a huge step. Well, I will literally talk through it, and it will sound like it's not such a huge step. And sometime tomorrow, you'll say, wait a minute, he said what? And then it will become a huge step in your head. It is, in fact, not a huge step. Say, well, look, if I can serialize the state of a page to put it out to disk, or if I can serialize the state of a method call on a kernel object, it's not such a huge leap to imagine, hey, I could serialize the process state as well. Right? I could take a process, I could say, here's a process data structure, hand me a string that records all this data, right? And I'm going to hand it off to somebody else, and after I've done that, I'm going to declare this entry in the process table is now available for reuse.
Are you saying that all of these messages are encoded in actual strings?
Yes.
Isn't that ridiculously slow? Because you figure this stuff is happening a lot.
No, it's not happening a lot. The kernel's a very big cache. It owns all of your memory.
Yeah, but how many times are you sending messages?
Only when you load something in the cache.
Oh, okay.
So, indeed, the it's not that we want to send a lot of messages. Is that we want to move from a kernel which has a process table of 1,000 entries to a kernel that logically has a process table of 1,000,000,000 entries, but most of those processes are not active. Maybe only a couple hundred of them are active. And for those, we want to keep them in memory. But you know, the thing about processes that aren't running and we're not communicating with them is it really doesn't matter how long it takes to not talk to them.
Okay.
Now there are some catches, because if I want to be able to push state in and out of the kernel this way, I have to have some discipline about who owns the state at which time, who's entitled to do what. And as I'm moving it out or pulling it back in, I gotta make sure I don't get in my own way. Let me go a step further. Hey, if we can do it with the process state, we can do it with the mapping structures. I mean, it's all just bits at some level. And now here's the interesting part. Suppose we were to design the kernel as follows. We're going to make a division between the definitive state, right? This is the state, it's the official state of the machine. And the operational state. So, for example, if there's some data structure where to make efficient use of this data structure, maybe I have to convert its representation to something more convenient. Or I have to do some kind of dependency tracking. The dependency information, the rearranged version, the one in which I've done formatted conversion on the bits, that's all operational state. And there are two kinds of operational state. The first kind is stuff I've done for tracking purposes. If I'm going to take out the object, all that stuff can be thrown away. I mean, have to undo it in a clean way, but I can throw it all out. Right? It's just sort of temporary working state. The other kind is I had some data structure up here that was organized for convenience of external definition. But in order to make efficient use of it, I need to convert it to some other representation. And it may even be that the representation has a different size. So what I may have to do is basically make a private copy of the data structure. As I'm copying it, I'm writing it out in a different way. I make my modifications on the private copy, and then before I export this data structure, I basically have to copy them back. So, for example, I said objects have an object ID. Well, imagine that was true of a file. Then the file descriptor now, which is something I have to be able to externalize because it's part of the process state. Well, inside the kernel, assuming that the descriptor is open and the file is in the kernel, I really want this thing to have a pointer to the appropriate VFS. Right? I don't want to have to do some kind of a number resolution to look up from the OID to the pointer every time I touch the file. That would be silly. So, in the internal view of this data structure, I'm just going to have a pointer. But the other side of this story is, if I were to pick up that data structure with that pointer, and push it up to some object server and say, store this. And a week later, I'm running this process again, and I say, give me back that process, and I get back this data structure that has this pointer in it. Hey, the file is moved. This pointer is useless. So what I need to do is I need to convert it back to a number so that I can reconnect it when the file comes back. And in the object database world, this is called swizzling and unswizzling, and I always forget which one is which. So, this field that holds this pointer, what you do is you put a marker bit in it, and the marker bit tells me which format it's in. If it's in the internal format, then it's a valid pointer to some object. And by the way, if it's in the internal format and it's a valid pointer, I better know the object's there. If it's in the external format, I use the OID instead. So the idea is when I pull this thing into the cache from the object store, what the object store hands me has these object IDs, and the first time I use them, I do a lookup to find the target object, which may involve loading the target object. But eventually I've got the target target object loaded, and there comes a point, I do look up on the side and you say, oh, I've got it, and I put it over there. Now that I know where it is, let me update this field, and I will overwrite the OID with a pointer so I can get to it fast the next time. So I'm actually doing caching in the data structure itself. What I'm caching is the result of the OID lookup. And then I put in a bit that tells me which state this field is in. When I go to push this back out, I have to get the OID back. So part of this is that the object itself is going to have a header structure, and in that header structure is the OID. This is actually how I did the lookup in the first place, right? I'm matching one OID against the other. But because I have the pointer to the target, and because the target knows its own OID, I can always undo this. So, let me just pause and say, if you get the trick, what we're doing here is a funny kind of a serializable pointer. Anybody confused about this step? Because this is critical. Alright, so if we do this pervasively, just throughout the system architecture, we can take all of these things and we can push them out to an object store, we can actually turn the machine off. And assuming we have some magic way to get the object store restarted, we can even reload it. And we're going to use these kinds of marker bits to tell us, you know, before we push an object out, we have to actually sort of clean up any recording we've done, any conversion we've done. So this is an example of the pointer form is operational state. The OID form is definitive state. So the official state of this descriptor is the one with the OID. That's the one that has permanence. The pointer is a temporary caching artifact. That's operational state. Another example of operational state. Since I'm going to define everything as objects, one of the things that I have to describe as objects is how the memory mapping system works. So I'm going to end up with some kind of a data structure that conceptually occupies the same role as the page table structure. But I need this to be something I can push out to the object store. So in this structure, what I'm going to do is where the page table had page table entries. What this structure is going to have instead is what are known as page capabilities. Capability is just kind of a descriptor. And it simply consists of an object identifier and some permissions. If I want to walk this structure, and I'm going to have trees. When I want to have access to a page, I'm going to walk the tree. And each step, I'm going to look up the OID. After I look up the OID, that'll cause me to force in the next layer. When I do a successful lookup, I convert it. Progressively, I'll make it all the way down the tree. Finally, I'll get to the actual page. Now, this is completely useless if I want to use this for hardware, which is what I really want to do. Right? Obviously, somehow I want to get this loaded into hardware because we really don't want to do a tree walk for every loaded store operation. That would be nuts. But with sufficiently clever data structures, I can keep track of which paths I've walked here. And off on the side, I can build the actual page table. Okay? And this capability points to a page and has a set of permissions. And this PTE, once I get it all set up, is going to point to the same page. And then once I get it loaded, my hardware is going to reference the page table. On demand loading the memory map. Just like before, we would have demand loaded the page. There's about 3 years worth of detail on how to do this correctly, which obviously I'm not going to do in the next 20 minutes. But are you prepared to believe that one could pull this off with enough care? There's one catch about it, which is, actually there are two. If this page gets taken out of memory by the cleaner, for example, I need to have enough of a reverse data structure to take this PTE and make it invalid so that I know the page went away. And I need that generically in an operating system, right? If I page out a page, even without any of this stuff, obviously I have to turn off all the page table entries and point to. Well, in this system, I also have to put this capability back into its definitive form because I can't leave it with a pointer to something dangling. But that's actually just repeating the same problem we had before, right? Just like we had to invalidate the PTE, we've got to do something with the capability.
So that's the first one.
The second problem is, once we make this mapping object first class, it too has an OID. And in fact, an application can hold the capability of this object, and it could store it in this slot. It could overwrite this page capability with a different page capability. And if that happens, again, I need to invalidate the page table entries because the hardware structure now, what I'm doing here is I'm saying, look, the software structure, it defines what the state of the address space is. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the hardware structure as a cache for efficiency purposes. But if somebody changes the official state, I have to invalidate the cache. Suppose I did this style of thing for processes, for pages, and for mapping structures. By the way, in the system that actually works in the way that I've described here, this mapping structure is called a node. In principle, that's all the state there is in a kernel. I mean, there's some other state. I've got to track interrupt state. I've got to track DNA, right? But all of that's operational state. If I turn the machine off and I power it back up, I can rediscover the hardware. I can set the interrupts up again. The only state that you as a user care about is the state of the processes. And because you care about that, you care about what's in their address spaces. And that's all the state there is. Now, in this system, there's an interesting thing that happens. I can just take, if I want to shut the system down, I can push all this state out to the object store. I just quiet everything, just stop running everything, push it out to the object store. Right. Tell the object store, okay, write everything down. And when the object store comes back and tells me it's written down, I can hit the power switch. Because I get the whole thing back. You have a question?
Yeah, how long does that normally take? Right, like
depends on how I do it. That's the right question, and I'm getting there. But in principle, is it plausible that I might actually do that? There's actually one more piece of information. I need to have a bit for each process that says, at the time that I pushed this process out, was it running or was it blocked on something? Because if it was blocked, I don't want to start it running again. And there's actually a tricky bit there, which makes it really hard to do this in Unix. Suppose at the time that I wanted to get rid of this process, the process was in the middle of a system call. So it's sitting somewhere in the kernel. It's on a stall queue, it's on a sleep queue, right? And it's got a kernel stack trailing behind it that leads back up to user land. That's something I really don't want to say. In fact, I really want to make it just back out and start a system call over again. That would be the clean way to solve this problem. So to make this stuff actually work cleanly, I need to design my system to have what are called atomic system calls, which I'm talking about with you guys. So if my process is in the kernel at the time I decide to do this, I basically just, I bounce it back to the user instruction where it started the system call. Because if I have atomic system calls, there are really only two states conceptually that I can be in, right? The system call's done, or the system call has not had any effect yet. That's what it means for the system call to be atomic. So if it's done, I'm good. If it hasn't had any effect yet, I can just kick it back and make the fork I restarted. Okay, so I got to keep track of which processes are running. That's actually all the state there is. And by the way, I'm not cheating. That's really all the state there is. Do you have a question here?
Okay.
Let me offer a couple of peculiar observations. If I had a system that worked this way, I wouldn't need a file system. This is a system where processes continue to run until you forcibly kill them. Even if you shut the machine down, when you power the machine back up, that process is going to continue. The only reason you have a file system is because you need a place to put things so that they will survive when you shut the machine down, and because you shut the machine down, all of your processes went away. Imagine you had an operating system that never crashed. I understand your evidence for this is a little short in the air. Okay, but if you had an operating system that never crashed, and if you could rely on your laptop battery, right? Just hibernating your laptop and reopening it, right? You could do that forever. What do you need a file system? And in fact, that hibernate is the poor man's version of the design strategy I'm sketching. It's limited because it's not a caching trick. It's just saving an image in the machine memory. And so it doesn't have the scalability property that I could have a couple of hundred active processes out of a billion processes and it would all just work. I'm getting paging out of this design beyond just saving this kernel state. But hey, you know, there are actually laptops being sold for executives that don't have a hard drive. They only have main memory, and if you lose the battery, you're toast. And the reason is, hey, you double the battery life if you take a drive out. And they're lighter weight. And executives like expensive toys. And the puzzling part is those systems actually work reasonably well because they don't crash that often. And you also take a lot of complexity out of the system when you take out the drive. All right. So the question you asked was, well, isn't this expensive? The answer is, of course it's expensive. Let's see if we can observe some things that will let us reduce the expense. First, if the object has not been modified since I loaded, I don't need to push it out anymore, right? The object store already has it. Oh, and let me also say, I've left out an important detail, which is I have to have a way to destroy objects to get their space back, and when I destroy them, I have to know enough that they're gone. So having just the OIB isn't good enough. What I need is some kind of an allocation counter so that I don't have to go, when I destroy the object, I don't want to have to go searching the disk looking for all of these descriptors. So just having a counter that says, is it still good, is good enough. Every object has a counter. If the counter in the object does not match the counter in the descriptor is dead. Okay. If the object is not modified, if it's not dirty, I don't have to save it. The demographics are only 75% of the objects in your machine memory are dirty at any given time. There are exceptional situations. That's basically the saving theory. But there's something else you can do. One of the cute things you have here is because I have the ability to push an object out at any time, what's a side effect of that? Well, a side effect of that is all the references to that object turn into this externalized form. But I can get them back, right? If I have a reference in an externalized form, and I still need to use it, I can reconvert it. Now, this is kind of interesting because it means, suppose for some strange reason, I had an object in memory, it was in the way, and I wanted to move it someplace else. One way I could do that is I could say, well, I'm going to pretend that I'm going to ship this object out to the object store. So I'm going to do the first step of that, which is to convert all the references back to their external form. Now I know there are no more pointers to this object. And if there are no more pointers to this object, I can move it. I know, by the way, I wasn't really going to send it to the object store at all. The whole point of getting rid of these pointers was so I could move the object. And now the user of the object will re-execute the lookup process and they'll find the object in its new location. The only pointer I have to update is my in-memory directory of where my objects are. Well, there's a variation on this theme that I can do. I could say, oh, I have to, for some reason, I've decided to save all the system state. Now, here's the thing. If I'm going to save all the system state, I want to save it all as it exists at some particular moment in time. I don't want it moving while I'm trying to save it. Not a file at a time. I want a snapshot of the entire state of the machine. Why? Because I have a bunch of different processes. These processes are going to survive. And these processes are talking to each other. And they've done communication with each other. And they've established, they've negotiated agreements about what they're doing, right? One guy says, if I send this message, I expect that you're going to behave in a certain way. And the way that you're going to behave may depend on the messages I sent you back before. So if when we come back, we don't agree what time it is, and you don't agree, you know, I think I've sent 3 messages, and you think I've sent 2, or 4, we're out of sync. We're not consistent. So I want to get a snapshot of a frozen moment of the entire machine. And now it's not just that I have to serialize all this thing, but I have to wait for it before I let anything else happen, you might think. Turns out that's not the case. Here's what I can do instead. What I need to do is I need to ensure that until I get it saved, that the version of the object that I need to save stays around. It doesn't get thrown out, it doesn't get modified. Once I save it, that constraint is over. But until I save it, I gotta hang on. Meanwhile, you wanna get on with your computation, right? So indeed, you said, hey, this, you know, this sounds all very nice, but I really don't wanna wait for my, you know, I just loaded up my machine with 4 gigabytes of memory. That means I got to put 1 gigabyte of stuff to disk. And you know what? I'm really going to notice how long it's going to take. So I don't want to wait. And if I'm going to make progress, the first thing I'm going to do is start a process. Some process, doesn't matter which one. And the minute I put that process in the CPU, the process is modifying its registers. And the minute it's modifying its registers, logically, it's modifying the process object, and I just said I can't modify the process object. So what do I do instead? I use copy on write. I take the old process object, and I've got a bin in it that says, this one's frozen because I got to save it. And you come along and say, but I want to modify it. You say, fine, let me find some free storage. I'll copy it over there. Go ahead and modify the copy. And I'll remember that I did this copy. I'll write down the old one. And if, when the old one's done being written down, there are 2 possibilities. Either I was forced to make a copy or I wasn't. If I wasn't, now the old one just goes on until the cleaner takes it out. If I had to make a copy, now the old one's dead. I've saved it. I just drop it on the floor. That space is now free. You can apply the copy and write idea to the entire system structure. And what that means in practice is, you're not going to wait for that gigabyte of stuff to go out. The only part that you have to do quickly is just making the notes that these objects have to hold still. You don't actually have to write them down. You can do that in the background. What you do have to do is get them marked so they don't move out from under you. called a snapshot. Process of getting it out is called a checkpoint. And now we'll steal a trick from the log structured file system, which is every time we take one of these snapshots, that's going to be a transaction number. And every time we successfully push that snapshot out to disk, we're going to update a transaction on the disk. And that means we have a recoverable system state even if this mechanism fails. Because either the current snapshot makes it, great, you know, I've got something to recover from. Or the current snapshot gets halfway out and the system crashes. Fine, I'll recover from the previous snapshot. I can still get to that because I had a transaction number. So now your question is reduced to, well, how fast can I do the snapshot? Because what you're concerned about is interactive response, right? That's what's behind the question here. Well, the actual implementation that was done in Kikos, the snapshot phase drops to the kernel, scans all of memory, it marks the snapshot bits on the objects. In the process of marking the snapshot bits, it invalidates page table entries because we're gonna drive the copy on write by using the page fault mechanism. So we're just gonna turn off all the page table entries, which is expensive. And having scanned through memory and marked all the objects, goes back to user land, and we start page faulting like crazy, and as we're page faulting, we start copying the objects that we need. Strictly speaking, it doesn't invalidate the page tables. What it does is it turns off write permissions. So anything that was readable, we don't install them. Turns out you don't have to do that. So the answer to that is, hey, that worked really well if I had a system with 64 megabytes, or 128 megabytes, right? A system with 4 gigabytes, scanning the memory can take a long time. Let me be clear, when I say scanning the memory, I don't mean we're looking at every byte. I mean, for every object in memory, we have a maintenance structure, a header structure. We have to go through all the header structures. That's where the snapshot bit lives. So it's a small fraction of memory, but still, at a 2 gigabyte memory, that fraction is pretty big. It's a noticeable way. But it turns out there's one more trick to do. And the one more trick is to say, you know what? I don't have to visit the objects. I have to color the objects. What I'm going to do is I'm going to have two states, black and white, or black and red. I'm going to start with everything in memory is in the black state. When I want to take a snapshot, I'm going to flip one word. The one word says, hey guys, we're now in the red state. And the way I handle these page faults is, I'm now going to page fault on everything. But if the object's not dirty, if it doesn't have to be saved, I say, oh good, it's not dirty. I can recolor it. Object, you are now red. I'm in the red state. It is now legal to make a reference to. If the object is dirty and not yet saved, I'll do the copy on write. The copy will move to the red state. If the object is dirty but it's been saved, again, I can just declare that it can move to the red state because it has been successfully saved. Now, so the stuff that I'm actually running will forcibly pull stuff into the red state. And in the background, I will do this cleaning process. But the point is I'm doing it in the background. And so the background is then going to try to get all the stuff that I missed because I'm not really using it, try to get all that stuff into the red state too. Now, what I have to manage is I've got to get everything into the red state before I snapshot again. Because when I snapshot again, I'm going to say, by the way, guys, we're now in the black state. I'm going to just do the whole thing again. So it turns out I can do the snapshot in unit time.
What's the color? You mean no offset changing at all?
No offset changing at all. We just need a way to know whether the object is current or whether I've got to do something about it. It's one bit per object. And it turns out I don't have to touch the bit on the object. The test is not which way is the bit. The test is, does the bit agree with the global marker? It's the global marker I'm going to change. Okay, last piece of this. I said we're going to do this with a transaction. Here's the mechanism. There's a checkpoint log. There are the rest of the disk is the backing store for the object store. So the object manager, you know, the kernel says, do something about this. The object manager says, I got it. Put it someplace on the disk. Here's the system memory. We're just going to use the usual transactional mechanism. Writes always go to the log. Reads can come from either place. The rule is a read should always deliver the most current object. To know where to look, in memory, we have a directory of what's in the log at the moment. That's how we know where to look in the log. Failing the log, we just go to the object store. As we dribble objects out, we're dribbling them out to the log. When we're done dribbling them all out, the log has two headers. So when we're done dribbling them out, we update the header. We're saying, here is the end of the last successful transaction. That's the one we're going to recover from. And when we've successfully done that transaction, we migrate. Put the objects back in their home location. Now, this looks like a lot of extra I.O. because of the migration. And in contrast to EXT3, all of the state has to go to the log because even page state is inside the transaction. We're not just trying to recover metadata here. We're trying to keep everything consistent. But it turns out it's not as simple as how many writes do I do if you're trying to evaluate performance. There are two factors that mitigate this. Number one, more than half of the stuff that goes to the log never gets migrated because it gets modified again. The minute it gets modified again, we don't have to migrate it. I went through that yesterday. The second is, when I start this migration, I'm not migrating one cruddy little file. I'm migrating hundreds of pages. Because I'm migrating hundreds of pages, the first thing I do is I say, okay, everything I gotta migrate, good, let me sort the list. And now, for those 100 objects, I'm not doing 4 billion passes over the object store, I'm gonna do them in one pass. The only reason I interrupt that pass is because you need to read an object to make progress. And that should get higher priority because we want you to make progress. The cost of I.O. is the sinks. It's not the writes. By bulk sorting the writes, many of which, by the way, are highly localized because when I originally set up the objects, I made them localized. By bulk sorting the writes, the amortization of the sinks is much improved, so much so that the performance in the system is actually better than the performance of a conventional file system, even though it's saving more data. It is saving things like your stack state than in a file system-based system you would never save. The reason that doesn't have any impact, all the I.O. here is linear, and it happens over 2 to 3 tracks, and your stack state is dirty. It's very dirty. The minute we're done saving it, it gets written again, so it never gets migrated. Linear I.O. is free. And there's a long paper about that. So I wanted you to see this, and we will pick up next week.